Welcome to Biohackers Lab, a place where we talk to smart people who are figuring out how to improve health in interesting ways. Join us to discover how you can biohack your life, your body, starting today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Biohackers Lab. I'm your host, Gary Cohen, and on today's show, I have Dr. Brianna Stubbs. And Brianna is a specialist in ketones. That's why I've got her on the show today. Just to give you a little bit of background about her, she's done her PhD in physiology, in particular researching ketones at Oxford University. And not only has she got her PhD, she's also now a retired Team GB rower. So she's competed for Team GB at both the junior and senior levels, where she's won gold medals twice at the World Champs. Not only has she rowed for Team GB, she's also rowed for Oxford University in the women's boat race twice, and she's won that twice. And then another fascinating point about Brianna is that she's also the youngest person to have rowed across the English Channel when she was age 12. So, Brianna, you're an overachiever, which is an understatement. A bit
Thank
of an
you for having me on today.
Sure. I'm so glad that you came on because, as I mentioned earlier, you're a ketone expert, and we're going to delve deeper into the world of ketones today. So if you wouldn't mind to help people who don't understand the word ketone, if I just simplify it, ketones is just a form of natural energy that the body relies on, and it might be seen as the opposite to glucose. So in someone who's eating just a normal diet, are they producing ketones for energy and not only relying on glucose for energy?
So yes is the simple answer. Normally, after an overnight fast, a person who's just consuming a normal diet might have 0.1 or 0.2 millimoles of ketones in their blood. So that's really quite low. And that means that these people they have ketones there and they are able to use them, but it's not really contributing in a significant way to their metabolism. And so really when they're just sitting there at rest, their body is burning glucose and fat. But if you were to prolong your overnight fast and fast the rest of the day until maybe the following morning, that would mean that your stores of carbohydrate in your body would get depleted. And that starts to become a bit of a problem for your brain, because your brain's really reliant on glucose and carbohydrate to keep it going. And we all know about 4 p.m., a little bit after lunch, people get a bit dozy. If you have a sugary cup of tea or a biscuit, you perk right back up again. And that's just the feeling of your brain having its fuel, glucose, there available for it. So evolutionarily, it's a bit of a problem if you haven't got any carbohydrate in your diet, if you fast or if you're following a low carbohydrate diet. So the body's answer to that is to produce ketones. And so if you continue to either starve or restrict your dietary carbohydrate intake for a longer time, the levels will go up from that 0.2 kind of normal basal level, go up above about 0.5, which is where we define you being in ketosis, and then start to build up slowly to maybe 0.5 to 1.5 millimolar, depending on how long you fast for. And when it starts to get up to that sort of level, then ketones can be contributing really very meaningfully to fueling your brain. And it's been found that the brain, up to 60% of the brain's energy requirements can be met by ketones in that sort of situation. So everyone's naturally adapted to be able to produce and burn these fuels. And it's kind of interesting when you look back in evolutionary biology, the enzymes that are involved with ketone metabolism start to appear as organisms started to get bigger and bigger brains. So it's not just something that humans do. It's really common in like dairy cattle as well. And also really, really common in infants, baby humans and baby rodents, that sort of thing. It's like wherever the brain is really precious and demanding a lot of energy, those organisms, things tend to have a very ready ability to produce and burn ketone bodies. So it's something that we can all do naturally. Thus, ketones aren't an unnatural substance.
Well, it's interesting. You just got me thinking where you mentioned about babies and infants, because I did an interview with Mariki Zaboris, who's the head journalist for the Prof. Tim Noakes case. I don't know if you've come across that in South Africa, trial that he's gone through, and it's not even completed yet. They've just started it up again with an appeal, I see. But it did sort of get banded around then. If, you know, for infants and low carb, and Prof. Noakes wasn't trying to say go low carb in an infant, but it was it was something that I don't think I'd come across before, that breast milk, for example. Would that, because that's such a high fat content, that the baby actually is in this, is producing a higher level of ketones? And
Exactly.
Has anyone ever tested to see if babies are in nutritional ketosis?
I'm sure they have, but I wouldn't be able to, like, with any real, like, authoritative numbers at you. But it's a phenomenon that's quite widely recognized, that it's a much more important fuel source for infants.
Yeah. And that's actually what got me into the world of ketones to start with, was the ketogenic diet and children who have uncontrolled or epilepsy that can't be controlled by medication typically. And I found it amazing to think that these ketones that can be produced through the diet by eating a higher fat diet can help heal the brain and stop it from, and help the neurology. So it seems like we definitely need ketones for the brain to perform well.
Well, I wouldn't say that we need them for the brain to perform well, but they are like a really, really good fuel source for the brain if it can't get glucose. So some people ask me, so if ketones are so good for the brain, why aren't we in ketosis the whole time? And I think it's actually just kind of, it's just a quirk of evolution. You know, everything was, if you think about when the very first single-celled organisms came around, they probably weren't doing any aerobic respiration and they were doing anaerobic glycolysis, but burning carbs to form lactate. So we just probably evolved to be burning glucose first, because actually the sort of pathway for keto metabolism production anyway is a bit more complex. And so that you can kind of see that that might have arrived further down as an answer to the big brain problem. So it's not that ketones are less good than glucose, but they are at least as good. So when you've got the brain of a child with epilepsy or the brain of someone with Alzheimer's disease who's having neurodegenerative problems, a lot of those problems can be linked to dysregulated or insufficient glucose metabolism. So if your brain isn't sufficiently able to burn glucose and there is no ketones because you're following a normal diet, then the brain just has insufficient energy. However, if you have a pathology that means you have insufficient glucose metabolism, and then you provide ketones, then that can bypass the block and mean that the brain can still have enough energy to function. And so that's how we think that ketone bodies, not necessarily so much with epilepsy, there might be other mechanisms at play there, but ketogenic diets have been implicated in neuroprotection in Alzheimer's. And so quite a few studies have now definitively shown that hypo, so lowered brain glucose metabolism comes, is apparent and measurable very much earlier than the actual symptoms of dementia. So your brain starts to get metabolically kind of impaired. And that's probably one of the root causes of dementia. And so if you are in ketosis, then you provide the brain with energy and perhaps slow down that decline.
That's fascinating. So is there a way that you were saying, so there's a way for us to test the brain that's not being able to function to get enough energy from glucose, did you say, before Alzheimer's?
I believe it's like PET scanning, or there's quite a lot of ways that we can measure glucose metabolism. Is quite an easy thing to measure in the body. So I think they do looking at specific regions of the brain.
To light up,
And pinning down the glucose metabolism in a healthy brain and the glucose metabolism in a pre-dementia brain, and then on into a dementia brain. And so if there is hypo or impaired glucose metabolism, then providing ketones is a way to bypass that and make sure that the brain's still got energy. So, not necessarily, it's not really a competition between ketones and glucose necessarily. They're good for different things, but both kind of, like you said at the offset, like carbon skeletons that our bodies can break down to provide energy, which is essential for life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So the jury's out saying that ketones, even in someone who's got good glucose metabolism, it's not going to protect their brain if they try to raise their ketones? Or I know this is going to be a very gray area, I guess.
There's lots and lots of evidence emerging to suggest that providing ketones could have a lot of neuroprotective and sort of longevity and anti-inflammatory effects, not just in the brain, but through the whole body. Mm-hmm. So there's recently some good reviews of it's a huge topic. And there's some good recent scientific reviews that have come out that I can give you to link to in your show notes if you're interested. But you may have heard that calorie restriction is one of the things that's associated with longevity. So if you get shamans or Buddhist monks or people who regularly fast, they have, historic kind of conventionally have longer lifespans. It's been reported anecdotally, that was the word I'm looking for, anecdotally live longer. And part of the underlying mechanism for that, we believe, is ketone bodies, because they act as not only a fuel for the body, but they protect the DNA inside the body and protect the mitochondria from oxidative stress. So it's, I suppose the interesting thing is that there's still a lot of work to be done, because until now, when exogenous ketones are more readily available, the only way to really study this in humans anyway was by fasting people. And also really the interest in it has been kind of limited because people believe that ketogenic diets were dangerous because of the high fat content. And now there's been a bit of a shift in the general mood of society, where now sugar is the thing that we're all kind of trying to watch. There's some very interesting, like, kind of political and historical background as to why we went down the sugar route and now why we're sort of swinging back the other way. So I think we're really at the start of a bit of an era where this will be better understood. But as yet, it's still, we've done this in animals and that in animals, and so it's not clear yet. But ketone bodies have the potential to protect the brain, act as a fuel for the brain and the body, and then also protect mitochondria from oxidative stress, protect DNA, and upregulate genes associated with longevity. So potentially, holistically, quite a good thing to be burning for the body.
It sounds such a good fuel source. And and I know we won't get into the details of, I believe, the Krebs cycle, and that ketones can produce more ATP versus a glucose too. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct. People get a little bit confused between when we talk about more ATP, because you can look at how much ATP is produced per molecule in lots of different ways. So you can look at how much ATP is produced per beta-hydroxybutyrate or glucose, but then that's not really a fair comparison, because the different amounts of carbon in each molecule. So then you can standardize it, ATP per carbon or ATP per oxygen. So there are different ways of looking at it. Actually, I'm just going to look at my numbers out in front of me here, because I don't want to get this wrong. So actually, in compared with glucose, ketones don't produce more ATP per oxygen, and they don't produce more ATP, or they produce more ATP per carbon just, but I mean, actually it's sort of a little bit nip and tuck when you look at the basic kind of stoichiometry, so ratios of it. But actually where ketones deliver an advantage is through the energy stored within each ATP. So there's not necessarily more ATP being produced, but
more efficient ATP,
more potential, and the ATP has more potential to do work. So if you imagine you have a tennis ball in your hand, it's got this much potential energy here. But if I take it to the top of Mount Everest, it's got more potential to do work because it's got potentially further to fall. Mm-hmm. So it's a real subtlety, and I'm probably taking your listeners a little bit deep here, but it frustrates me a little bit when people say, oh, it's more ATP, it's more. It's actually, a scientist would, and the scientist in me gets a bit like, because it's not. You know, you could quite happily sit there with your Krebs cycle diagram and work out, you know, how many ATP are being produced per carbon or per molecule or per oxygen. And there's no clear cut advantage there, but there is a clear cut advantage in the stored energy within the ATP. So there's more potential energy to do work. And the mechanism for that happening is by changing the difference in electrochemical gradient for the electron transport chain. So you mentioned that energy is produced inside organelles in our cells called mitochondria. That's where all the energy in the body is produced. And how that happens is by setting up a gradient, a little bit like a dam, from one side of the mitochondria to the other, and then protons flow down this gradient like a dam, and that's what the stored energy from those protons flowing is transferred into ATP. And so what happens when ketones are in the mitochondria is that dam kind of gets taller. So the water, the protons, is falling further. So there's more potential work then stored in the ATP. So because of the changes that the ketone make to that gradient, or the height of our sort of metaphorical dam, that's why the ATP has got more stored energy in it. And so it's not necessarily as simple as there's just more ATP. It's like The way, you know, another metaphor that I like to use, it's like putting higher octane fuel in your car. It's just inherently...
Same volume.
Yeah, inherently just... more energetic for the same volume.
Hmm.
There we go. That was really subtle.
No, but that's such a good point because, as you said, that does... I mean, that's what I've heard all the time, that ketones make more ATP. But as you said, that's technically not maybe the best way to explain things, so...
I probably shouldn't get such a big bee in my bonnet put on it, but I'm afraid that I'm going to get called up one day by someone. Well, and you know, here, especially here in Oxford, it's quite easy to talk to someone on the street and say, oh yeah, you know, ketones produce more ATP. And then I go into my science lab and I work with some people who are really hardcore metabolists. And one of them examined me for one of the sort of examinations of my PhD. And she was like, well, there's just not more ATP per molecule, you know, let's get this table out. And she, you know, and she was right, you know. You can't just say that that's the case when you have to understand the subtleties of it. And so I don't believe in dumbing it down for people.
Yeah. No, it's good. I think for the general public to know that too, that it's we're actually getting more into electron transfer because that's how the... And just if anyone doesn't know what a mitochondria is, the way I like to describe it is like a little battery that we have in all of our cells, except I believe red blood cells is the only cell that doesn't have a mitochondria.
I think it's probably they do just anaerobic respiration.
All right. And but anyway, so these little mitochondria are what we depend on to produce energy, which and this energy is called ATP. So yeah. And
And just to make another little interesting sort of sideline point. So we were talking there about the electron transport chain being like a dam and ketones making that dam taller so there's more distance for the water to fall and more energy. So that's what happens when we put ketones in exogenously. And endogenously as well. But if you follow a high-fat diet, over time, your mitochondria do this thing called uncoupling. So it provides like an alternative route for the... They just express these things called uncoupling proteins over time following a high-fat diet. And that uncouples the process of electrons flowing across the membrane or down the dam from energy production. So it's like again, you've got your dam, but then you kind of got some streams off the side that aren't going through the turbine. So it's sort of dissipating some of the potential energy. So actually being in ketosis as a result of a high fat diet may not be inherently as efficient as artificially raising your ketones.
Okay, yeah, I would definitely be getting into that aspect of artificial ketones versus natural occurring ketones from fasting or dieting. But before we get on to that point, if we just mentioned there are three major types of ketones, is that correct chemically, that people might get to hear about? Would you mind just explaining those three?
Of course. So during starvation, your fat cells release lipids. Lipids travel to the liver, and the liver is the organ of the body that is mainly responsible for ketone production. And the main ketone body that the liver reproduces inside the cells is called acetoacetate. And then that sort of forms an equilibrium reaction. So it's kind of converted into another ketone body called beta-hydroxybutyrate. And those are the two that are mainly present and measurable circulating in the blood. Now, acetoacetate can also undergo a conversion to a ketone body called acetone. And people have sometimes heard of ketones with a pear drop breath smell. Or if people following a ketogenic diet, you can smell them on the breath. And that is generally the acetone that people can smell. So beta-hydroxybutyrate, acetoacetate, and acetone are the three main ketone bodies present.
Okay. And I think probably out of those three, I'm guessing in the general media, the biggest one most people would hear about is the beta hydroxybutyrate. That's the one I tend to hear more of. But
that's the one that people tend to measure with the little blood finger pricks. We tend to measure that one because normally, physiologically, beta hydroxybutyrate is present at higher levels than acetone. So I believe the natural ratio can be around 4-1. It's definitely not 1-1. It depends on how high the levels of ketones are in the blood. Another reason I think that people focus on hydroxybutyrate is that acetoacetate in the blood anyway is quite hard to measure. It's quite it's a difficult reaction to do. Acetone, again, measure it in the breath. But it's not necessarily directly correlated to the ketones in the blood. So the gold standard way for telling how deep into ketosis that you are is by looking at blood beta hydroxybutyrate.
Mm-hmm. And this is where I believe there's two different, if we're going to get into the testing now, maybe I should bring you up now or we'll get into the testing, but let's do the testing. So we know there's these three types of ketones now, but you've already touched on the different ways of testing and that blood. So taking, so people can buy a bit like a glucose meter, but they can buy a ketone meter.
Actually, it's the same same machine.
Okay, it's just a different testing strip that picks up the ketone. And in this case, blood testing is, I guess, from a research point of view, is set as the gold standard to understand if the level of ketosis when you're testing.
Yeah.
But then, I've been educated by you that there's two different chemical formats of beta hydroxybutyrates.
Yes. So, as you were saying, we were just discussing before the show, beta-hydroxybutyrate is a molecule that has this property called optical isomerism, or it's called a chiral molecule. And that means that the atoms inside the molecule are arranged in the same way, much in the same way that my left hand and my right hand have four fingers and one thumb. It's the same molecule, but they're not superimposable on one another. So it's just it just means that there are two possible forms of hydroxybutyrate that are mirror images and not quite the same. The atoms are arranged a little bit differently in space. And in biology, quite a few molecules have this property. So one that we'll all have heard of is lactate. So with lactate, we always have the form, they're called L-lactate. Whereas with hydroxybutyrate, we have dehydroxybutyrate, not L-hydroxybutyrate, circulating in our blood. So we were just talking about the little handheld measuring kit for hydroxybutyrate that only measures dehydroxybutyrate, because all of the enzymes in our body seem to be specific to only be able to fit in that form, just much in the same, like you can't put your left hand into a right-handed glove without it being really uncomfortable. The enzyme won't process this form that it doesn't normally see. So normally the liver makes the D form, the measuring kit measures the D form. The D form is the form of hydroxybutyrate that's circulating in the blood. However, this other form called L-hydroxybutyrate does exist. And normally when you do a chemical reaction in a laboratory, you end up with a 50-50 mix of D and L, of any molecule that you're trying to make synthetically in a lab. It's just a naturally occurring phenomenon. Whereas it's only really in the body that we produce the one form. So that means that if you've got a ketone supplement that isn't explicitly telling you that it is D, that it's pretty likely that it's a mixture of the two, because it's quite expensive and difficult to separate out these two things, because they're really the same to a chemical instrument.
Hmm.
However, they're not the same to the body. As I was saying, you can't fit your right hand in your left glove, your left hand in your right glove. So when we put L-beta-hydroxybutyrate into the body, not only can we not measure it because our little measuring kit doesn't pick it up, but at the moment there's not very much research showing how it's handled by the body. And it's not dangerous, we don't think, but it's just not really very well understood at this stage, whether it's able to be burnt as a fuel, whether it's also able to act as a signal in the same way that the D form is. So it's a bit of a question mark at this stage. But it's an interesting thing, because people might take a ketone supplement and measure their hydroxybutyrate, but they won't be measuring half of it because it's the L form that isn't being measured by the measuring kit and may not be being burnt by the body.
Yeah, I think probably I'm guessing most people who are on a ketogenic diet or trying to follow the nutritional ketosis levels wouldn't even have known about that difference in the D's and the L's. And
but it's not really relevant for them, because if they're achieving ketosis through diet, then it's only what their body is producing, and their body is only producing D.
Because I believe I've heard you mention, did they find that the L form inside cells, whereas the D is on the outside of the cells, which is also a reason why it's so difficult to test the L levels?
Well, so yes, researchers have had a look inside our cells and found L-hydroxybutyrate, because it's a metabolic intermediate in some other pathways inside the cell. So it means other pathways are using L-hydroxybutyrate to kind of get to another end goal, but they're not releasing it to use as a circulating fuel. That doesn't mean that it's difficult to measure. That it's difficult to measure because we haven't got the enzymatic test that we use is specific to D. So when I've measured L in my own research, we have to send it off to get specific testing done that doesn't, that either doesn't discriminate between D and L. So what the two ways you can do it are measure total hydroxybutyrate in the blood using a machine that's not an enzyme machine. So therefore you get, you know, a level of 2, and then you use your blood ketometer and it says 1. And so you know that you've got 1 D and 2 total. So the rest is L. Or another sort of more kind of really, really nails down the fact that you've got L there rather than just inferring that you've got L there is by using a mass spectrometry machine or a special scientific detection machine that can specifically see you've got this much L and this much D. And so I've done that as well. So you can make sure that you're not just missing something or making it up, even though, you know, specifically seeing that you've got both there.
Okay, cool. But,
so someone who's producing their own ketone bodies may well have, we may all well have L-hydroxybutyrate inside ourselves, but that is not a circulating energy source in the same way that D is. However, if you're following a ketogenic diet, your liver will be producing and releasing D-hydroxybutyrate, and that can go around the body and be used as an energy source and as a signal as well. But the L form, it is unknown what happens if you artificially elevate it using a drink, and then what happens to that, whether it gets taken up and or whether it just gets excreted, or it's unclear at this stage.
So the body is producing the L form when you're on the ketogenic diet, too?
No.
No.
Not producing and releasing. Only if you take exogenous ketones would we expect to see L in the blood.
Oh, so L is completely man-made. It's not, well, it's, or does, or would the body break the D format down, do you think, into an L form? Is that, I don't even know.
No. Okay. So,
sorry, I'll pull us back on track with the testing, but yeah, this has got me.
It's okay. If I haven't made it clear to you, I won't have made it clear to the listener. So I'll try again. Two forms of ketone bodies, synthetically both exist in a half and half mix. However, in the body, D is the form that is released and circulates in the blood. There may well be L inside the body, but it is inside cells. It's a metabolic intermediate that is not released from the cells. So it may be present, but it is not a circulating form of energy. So if you have someone on a ketogenic diet, they will not have L-beta-hydroxybutyrate circulating in their blood. There will just not be any. They may have some inside their cells, a trace amount, but it's not a circulating energy form. They will have D-hydroxybutyrate circulating, and that will be used as an energy form. So that is someone who is on a ketogenic diet. If you have someone who takes a ketone salt drink that has got D and L in it, then they will have both D and L circulating in their blood, which is unusual because they have both forms circulating in their blood rather than the L being inside the cells. Is that clear?
That's very clear. Yeah, I got it. thank you. Yeah, I fully understand that now. So yeah, that's one of my questions I'm going to ask you about how we produce ketones, but I completely understand now when the liver produces the beta hydroxybutyrate, it's only releasing the D form. We do have the L form, but it's staying within the cell. Therefore, and from a diet perspective, you won't pick it up. But when you take, as you said, when we get on to talking about how you can raise your levels, you're going to have it in your blood because you've taken it.
Exactly. So I think there's a bit of a controversy in the ketone community at the moment where some people would like to say that L-hydroxybutyrate is bad and dangerous, and like, we just don't know, but it is a valid point that it's not usually in the blood. It is a natural kind of thing that can happen within inside cells in the body. You can't say it's never, ever, ever inside the body. It has been found, but it's not a major metabolite in the same way that D is.
Cool.
So jury's out.
Yeah. Right. So testing wise, we talked about blood. So you've got the measuring wise with the ketone strips, which a lot of people tend to do, I guess, when they're trying to monitor their nutritional ketosis levels. And that's also clinically, I guess, when we talked about the epilepsy, that's what the children might end up having to do to make sure that they're at that level. But then urine is another way. To the urine strips, but that's not very good from what I understand.
I suppose there are different pros and cons of different ways of testing. As you say, the blood weigh is the most accurate. And if you needed to hit a certain level for a clinical reason, that would be the best way. But some people don't find that very, some people have a real problem with finger prick samples. I mean, I don't. I personally come from a background of studying medicine and from being an athlete. I'm not at all squeamish. I don't have a problem with pricking my finger and taking blood. But some people do. And so non-invasive measures are much more preferable to these people for day-to-day use. And so that's where the urine dipsticks and the breath readers come in. Urine dipsticks are probably the cheapest out of the three. So you could buy a pack much, much cheaper than you would buy either an acetone reader, because that would be a one-off larger cost. As well as the meter, the handheld meter that you use for blood glucose and ketones itself isn't that expensive, but the strips that you put in it to read ketones are quite expensive. So I think they're about £1.20, £1.50 per strip. So like, you wouldn't want to be doing that regularly. And if you were super keen, perhaps would you be doing that? I mean, some people would see it as an investment, but quite a lot of people, they just want to know, am I in ketosis or am I not? And the urine should give you an idea if you're achieving ketosis through the diet. One thing that I have found with my research is that because when we take ketone drinks or artificial ketones, because levels go up really quickly, the urine isn't at all accurate because it hasn't had time really to
be excreted.
Go up in the urine as much as it's gone up in the blood. If you've been following a ketogenic diet, then your levels of ketones go up slowly, and urine ketone excretion should also kind of go up in relation to that up to a certain point. So it's a bit more accurate for that. But I mean, also there are individual differences in how much ketone we excrete. And also over time, if you follow a ketogenic diet for a very long time, then your kidneys get better at reabsorbing ketones. So it's sort of like, it's more like a yep or a nope rather than a, oh, exactly where am I? Am I fine tuning my levels, that sort of thing.
So someone who's just starting out this keto world, they starting with urine strips is not a problem, but just to say, like, yeah, you're hitting a keto level, but when you want to go deeper to actually find out where you are, that's when you'll need to use blood or as you mentioned, breath. And that's an interesting one I want to bring up, because I don't know, have you heard of a device called Ketonix?
I have heard of it, but I've not ever had the chance to use it myself.
Okay, yeah, I've got one of the devices, and so I've looked a little bit deeper into it, and they're trying to relate that your acetone levels, right? I've got the right white run. So your acetone levels do track your beta-hydroxybutyrate blood levels pretty well. There was one paper I think I saw. So
something that they released recently that showed that acetone was actually better at tracking blood glucose. It was funny because I think over time, like past a certain point, the relationship between acetone and beta-hydroxybutyrate was less good, but if your blood glucose continued to fall, then your acetone continued to rise. So I think as with the urine, it's not necessarily a super, super accurate way of doing it. Again, may change over time with how long you've been on a ketogenic diet. And again, not really relevant with our drinks because the ketone levels get up really quickly and it doesn't come out in the breath straight away. But
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, that people who are taking exogenous ketones don't rely that you're going to do the blood tests, the urine, or the, well, I get, sorry, not the blood, because you will be able to see it in your blood, but the urine and the breath tests. So that would be a weakness of those two tests if you're taking exogenous ketones.
Yeah, it's those two are not so good at real time tracking of really, really very rapid changes in blood ketone levels. However, if you're trying to maintain yourself in ketosis, then either of those two measures are adequate. If you prefer not to use blood, obviously blood is the gold standard. And if you get into a routine of when you take your blood ketone levels, then it doesn't have to be super expensive.
So is there a optimal time to be checking? If someone was trying to track their nutritional ketosis, should they be, is it a once a day thing, or is it, because I know, say with glucose, you want to do 2 hours postprandial testing. So after eating is ideally when you want to sort of see what your body's doing with glucose. But when it comes to ketone testing, would you have any advice as to what maybe people should be doing if they're trying to track long-term how they're doing with ketosis?
I think you should ask that question when you have, I know you have another ketone expert coming on a little bit later in the summer, Dominic D'Agostino, and he has followed a ketogenic diet himself for a really long time. And I think he'd give you a much, much, much better answer than I would, because he's really, really lived it and has tracked it himself.
Okay.
However, I believe that it's not best to do it first thing in the morning. I believe that it's sort of later in the day is better to do it. But again, check with him, you know, is the sort of thing maybe you'd want to do it after a fat rich meal, or ketones build up through the day. I mean, I'm if I'm honest, I'm not 100% sure. I think Dom would probably give you a better lived experience kind of answer for that.
Okay, cool. So now that we know about the three major ways of testing for ketones, blood is the standard, gold standard, and then breath and urine. But now we're going to get on into how do we get into nutritional ketosis, which is completely different. I just want to bring this up. That nutritional ketosis is very different to ketoacidosis, because that got confused in the Prof. Tim Noakes trial for some reason. I don't know how, but yeah, nutritional ketosis is a good type of ketosis. Ketoacidosis is when you've got a diabetic patient and their body's out of control, and that's a big problem. So just so people are aware, we're talking about how to get into nutritional ketosis in this sense. And so if we look at nutritional ketosis, is it correct that we've probably got three major ways? Fasting is the first way, which we've been talking about, where if you've had dinner and then there's been a period of time that you haven't eaten because you've been asleep, that you're actually in fasting, which is why it's called breakfast or breakfast. So you're breaking your fast in the morning. That's the one way. Then the second way is eating a high fat, low carbohydrate diet, or even going into a higher fat ratio, which is ketogenic. And then the third way is exogenous, which is taking ketones. And we're going to get into that, different formats of taking ketones externally. So just with fasting, to get into nutritional ketosis, how long do you have to fast before you're in nutritional ketosis? Is 12, I think I've heard 12 hours, and then you're starting to get into that, are you?
It's all quite an individual thing. Obviously 12 hours, that's longer than you would normally be fasting. I mean, so for some people, they would only be sort of 0.2, 0.3 millimolar then. So really, I think if you wanted to be sure that you were in ketosis, you'd be looking more at a 16 to 24 hour fast. So,
Brianna, is that when we get to that 0.5 millimolar range blood wise?
But it is very individual. Okay. It is very individual. So the longer that you're able to fast, the more likely that you are to be in nutritional ketosis. And also, if you were to do or have recently done, before you start fasting, some exercise and have depleted your body's carbohydrate stores a bit, then you would be more likely to get into ketosis faster, because in order to get into ketosis, you have to have low stores of carbohydrate in your body. So that either happens through, you know, prolonged time, or through having maybe exercised and depleted a little bit beforehand. And so there are lots of different fasting protocols out there, and these people coming up with different ways of doing it. I mean, like the 5-2 diet, which is like really, really universally kind of popular. That's one way that people try and fast on days. And I've never tried the 5-2 diet, but I find it's just easier to fast food altogether, because there's no question mark about whether or not you've hit calories. And I'm kind of a bit of an absolute kind of person. So it's just like, oh, I'm not eating until this time, or I'm not eating today. And I just find that mentally a lot easier to deal with. Mm-hmm. And so I have been, since I finished rowing, I've been experimenting with a 36-hour weekly intermittent fast as part of being part of the team at Nutrifox. And we do it as a team every Tuesday. Everyone just comes into the office in the morning, having not had breakfast, goes home, and then we all generally once a week will meet on the Wednesday morning and break our fast together, so long as everyone hasn't got sort of other commitments and that sort of thing. But it's definitely a lot easier to do in community, and it's just feel quite alert and quite productive during that time as your body gets into ketosis. But if 36 hours is too long for you, some people do a protocol where they compress their feeding window. So they have dinner and then don't eat again until lunchtime the next day. And then between 2 and 6 p.m. they eat, and they do that every day. So they still eat every day, but just sort of in a 4-hour window.
Yeah.
And the idea behind this is giving your cells and your body time to kind of do this process called autophagy, which is where the cells clear up any sort of debris and they have time to do repair and that sort of things, and also getting into ketosis as well. So there's quite a lot of potential benefits to fasting and a lot of different ways that you can do fasting. So you can either fast for 12 hours or fast for 16 hours or fast for 36 hours. And some people, some crazy people, and actually Nutribox earlier in the year, they did a seven day fast. They didn't eat for a week. And by the end there, their ketone levels were maybe like 4 to 5 millimolar. But just to put that in perspective, I can give someone a ketone drink and in half an hour, they'll be at 4 to 5 millimolar. So, I mean, that's a bit less of a painful way of doing it. So it takes quite a long time for ketone levels to build up. And to go back to what you said at the very start of this section, talking about ketoacidosis, the levels of ketones in the blood during ketoacidosis are often over 20 millimolar. So that's like four times as high as you'll get to after a 7-day fast. And if you were to carry on fasting for longer, your body would normally kind of top out between 5 and 10, let's say. Normally, I think the quoted figure is sort of 7 or 8. Your body reaches the natural plateau and will go along at that level because it's able to balance ketone production and ketone excretion and ketone metabolism. All of those things are nicely in balance, but where it's only with the diabetics where that checkpoint of insulin is not functioning properly or missing altogether, that signaling, that's when they build up and up and up and they go up to 20 millimole. And that's, you know, too much of anything is bad for the body. Too much glucose is bad for the body. So I think ketones got this unfair press, but it's because the levels are so high during ketoacidosis, much, much higher than following fasting or following ketone drinks as well.
Yeah. So that's a good point that people should realize that when you're raising your ketone levels through your diet, you're not going to get yourself into ketoacidosis unless you have an insulin problem or you there's an issue there. And the body always wants to do homeostasis, which is balance at the end of the day, physiologically. Yeah. It figures stuff out.
Just to emphasize as well, you were just saying unless you've got an insulin problem, but actually low carbohydrate ketogenic diets are often very beneficial for type 2 diabetics who are insulin resistant because providing the body with ketones rather than glucose to use stops them releasing insulin and can sort of help to improve their insulin resistance problems, or cutting down the carbohydrate in the diet can improve insulin resistance. So it's not dangerous for type 2 diabetics either when done kind of carefully and mindfully.
I'm going to actually get a couple of speakers on who use the low carb, high fat diet to manage type 2 diabetes and help people get off drugs and actually sort their bodies out again. So yeah, that's a good point to get across. Okay, so then we talked about the ketogenic diet, but we talked about fasting. That's another big topic. But then we've got low carb, high fat diet, which is different to a ketogenic diet. Also, I think people maybe need to know the difference there, where a traditional ketogenic diet is very low carbohydrate, where sometimes if we're talking colloquially, like what most people might be thinking nowadays, low carb, high fat, maybe that they're not going into full-blown ketogenic, would you say? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's quite a sort of it's a semantic kind of a choice of words. And I think I've never followed a ketogenic diet. I'm not a medical professional and I haven't ever supervised anyone on a ketogenic diet. I've read a lot about the different types and it just seems my impression from reading the literature and reading and hearing other people's experiences is that you need to individually change your carbohydrate intake depending on your kind of end goal and your own individual metabolism. So for some people, they actually need to have a very, very restricted carbohydrate intake in order to get into ketosis. And for some people, they can tolerate a lot more carbohydrates and still be in ketosis. And for some people, you need to include carbohydrates in and around working out or things like that in order to be able to do the physical performance. So you are right. If you were going to go away and look up the exact definition of a ketogenic diet and a low carbohydrate, high fat diet, and there's also diets that are less protein restrict, you know, low carbohydrate, but higher in protein and lower in fat. You know, you've got those three main dietary macronutrients and you can combine them in any which way you like, any person can. But the minute they start to get lower in carbohydrate, there's the potential for them to be more ketogenic because carbohydrate in the diet is the predominant thing that stops you from getting into ketosis. The stickler again in me is going to say, like, protein can be used to produce glucose. So if you are struggling with a ketogenic diet or struggling to get into ketosis following what you think is a ketogenic diet, then your protein intake may be too high, because your body can do this process called gluconeogenesis, so making new carbohydrate from protein. So that's a potential stumbling block for people trying to get into ketosis. Their protein intake may be too high. So really, carbohydrate is the one you really have to watch. Protein you also have to watch as well. And we have to get over as a society our fear of having a high fat intake in order to successfully follow this diet.
Yeah, I think that point there, what you mentioned about the protein, I think a lot of people, I know this happened when I was in South Africa, that when everyone heard Prof Tim Noakes say about low carb, high fat diet, they just went, oh, I can eat loads of meat. And it's like, well, no, meat's protein, which is different to fat, unless you have fatty cuts of meat. And you don't want to be overdosing with protein, because yeah, that could be an issue too. So fat is the key ingredient in this situation to achieve nutrition. So higher levels of fat and lower levels of carb are the two probably main key ones to hit this nutritional ketosis from a diet point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then your favorite topic now is exogenous ketones. So when we say the word exogenous, we're meaning by mouth. So
produced outside of the body. Yeah, so if you think about exoskeleton on a grasshopper or an insect or something, it means on the outside, as whereas endogenous is produced on the inside. So exogenous ketones are ones that are made by man, made synthetically, not made by the body. And you take them in a drink, or some people used to infuse them IV, but that's a lot less popular now.
Okay. So exogenous ketones is another big way that people are trying to achieve nutritional ketosis again. So you mentioned the word, so if I could get into that now. So already you've mentioned the word synthetic. So there's no way of producing in the lab finding natural ketones, or they always have to be sort of.
No, there's no chemically, there's no difference between a ketone made in the lab and a ketone made in your liver.
Okay.
They're structurally the same, because they're not a complex molecule like a protein or something like that. Then, the body can't tell the difference between one and the other. So if you take dehydroxybutyrate in a drink, it should behave exactly the same as dehydroxybutyrate that was produced by your liver. It should do.
I'm just thinking of the question of people who sometimes look at supplements and they want the natural form of something. So I was just interested in that.
That comes back to what we were talking about earlier about the D and the L. So in this case, it's the L form, which is the less natural form.
Mm-hmm.
And the D is the more natural form.
Okay. And then if we take the field of exogenous ketones, you mentioned IV, but that's not very, most people don't talk about that or think about that. But probably what's very popular in the field now is salts and esters. Is that right?
So the IV ketones were salts, and now the salts are in drinks. And now there are also esters in drinks as well. And so the difference between those two, an ester means that you've got a ketone bound to a ketone precursor. So the ester that I have been working on in my PhD is beta-hydroxybutyrate, D-beta-hydroxybutyrate specifically, the one that we've been talking about, bound by an ester bond or a chemical bond to an alcohol called D-butandiol. So again, specifically the D form of this alcohol. And what happens when you have this ester in your diet is it goes in as one molecule, and the esterases that are in our gut, we have lots and lots of esters in our food. They're very, very common, something that our body's used to handling. So our gut can break apart these two molecules. So then we've got beta hydroxybutyrate all ready to go, and that travels off in the blood, elevating your ketone levels. And you've got butandiol, and that goes to the liver. And the liver very rapidly converts that alcohol via the same pathway that we normally burn alcohol with into beta-hydroxybutyrate. So you get two molecules of beta-hydroxybutyrate produced from one molecule of ketone ester. Is that clear?
Yeah, that's very clear. So this is, again, coming back to, if we use that analogy of fuel, and this is octane again, where you can put in a substance and you're getting more bang for your buck.
Yes, from the one molecule of ester to two molecules of hydroxybutyrate. Now, there are also other groups looking at potential other ways to kind of stick ketones together. And so other ones that you might hear about in the future, there's an acetoacetate diester. So that rather than beta hydroxybutyrate, that's acetoacetate. I think it's esterified to, butanediol again, perhaps. But they use a different backbone and stick ketones on it. However, the ester that I've been working on is the only ester to date that has been tested and approved for human consumption and has been studied in humans. All of the others at this stage are still only in rodents. Then we could talk a little bit about why you might want to have beta hydroxybutyrate rather than an acetoacetate ester, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We believe, our group here in Oxford believes that focusing on beta hydroxybutyrate is better for fuel and performance because it's more chemically reduced. So do you remember we were talking about the dam? That's a function of the ketones producing a more reduced state inside the mitochondria, just to kind of slip back into heavy science mode here, as whereas acetoacetate, it's less reduced, so it's going to have that property of increasing the energy in ATP a bit less. However, the group that's researching the acetoacetate ester, they believe that's better for potentially epilepsy, which is what you were talking about at the start, because the mechanism for ketones helping epilepsy is not that well understood, but it's really strongly thought that that focuses on acetone. And the reason that it's not confirmed is that acetone is very, very volatile, very difficult to measure. And so we don't know how acetone is working in the brain, but they think the anti-seizure effect of ketone bodies is linked to acetone. And so if you produce lots of acetoacetate, you're going to get more acetone than if you provided BHB, hydroxybutyrate. It may be in the future that we end up with ketone esters that are better suited for different applications. So an acetoacetate ester might be better for seizure prevention, but a beta hydroxybutyrate ester might be better for fueling performance or more general use. So it may be that way. So ketone esters exist. There is one ketone ester currently and soon be available, hopefully, to buy for nutritional ketosis, and that butanediol and beta hydroxybutyrate, but others exist and others may exist in the future. And then, as you said, there's ketone salts, and those consist of beta hydroxybutyrate, the negative ion, coming in a package with sodium or potassium or another positively charged ion. So they're ionically bound in the solution. And so the ketone salts that are available often give beta hydroxybutyrate with sodium, potassium, or calcium, like I said. And interestingly, in the future, they've talked about combining them with any other positively charged atom like lysine, so like protein. They might be able to give ketone with protein as a salt, that sort of thing. So there's a potential for kind of new innovations there. But as I said, the big problems of these come in that most of them are racemic. So they have D and L, the physiologic, the normal, and this sort of like slightly less physiologic form, the L, inside these salts. The other thing is, obviously, there's very little consensus actually about how much salt is good or bad for us, right? But if you're going to take 6 grams of hydroxybutyrate, which is about what you would need to get a ketone level of 1 millimolar, you're going to need to take 6 grams of sodium. And compare that to what our recommended intake is, you're starting to get into quite high levels of sodium or potassium or calcium or whatever else you're taking in with the ketone. You're also taking that to excess as well. And so there's no, again, to my knowledge, nothing yet published on ketone salts ingestion in humans. They've looked at IV ketone salts in humans, and they've looked at ketone salts in rodents, but there's nothing in the literature about feeding just healthy people dietary ketone salts. So we don't know whether if you use this long term, whether you'd end up with an increased risk of, say, kidney stones or anything else that associate, or hypertension, anything else that could be associated with high levels of sodium or potassium or cation consumption. It's speculative at this stage. There's nothing saying that these things are bad. It's just you should approach it with caution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to just do your reading and make a decision if you choose these products. Okay, so then with the salts too, I didn't realize, because I'm thinking of some brand names out there, and they come in sachets, and that's what you would drop into water. People are just thinking, oh, just have loads of different sachets and just get yourself more into nutritional ketosis. But potentially they've got to think, yeah, how much sodium or, you know, salts that they're ingesting just by doing that route.
So one time, just as sort of a thought experiment, we weighed out the amount of sodium chloride and put it in a beaker, the amount that you were getting in one of these salt sachets. And it's like, imagine putting that much salt on your chips kind of thing.
Yeah.
And having that three times a day. I mean, like I said, the research around salt intake and health is pretty contentious, especially at the moment. There seems to be a lot of people shouting that salt's fine and it's, you know, fine and dandy. But I'm quite a moderate. And so my feeling would be, if you're going to use ketone salts, I would use them around the workout or, you know, to help you get, if you were fasting, to help you
get that little bit more.
But I would use it mindfully and really the ketone esters as well, there's, you know, very limited evidence of long-term use of all of these things in humans. So it's not necessarily going to be a replacement, you know, therapeutically, if you're looking to treat Alzheimer's, epilepsy, all of those things, it's definitely better to take ketone supplements around dietary changes and not just assume you can carry on eating your normal Western diet and get all of the benefits, because you may not.
So, yeah, because that's something I want to bring up, where people are, I guess, the keto world is becoming a lot more popular for the concept of weight loss or weight management.
Yeah.
And so I wonder how many people out there are thinking, oh, I can just eat my normal diet, but I can just take this sachet three times a day and I'll lose weight, or, you know, I'll manage my weight better. If anyone out there is thinking, oh, no, I'll just eat a normal diet, which might be higher in carbohydrates, but then I'll just have these salts that I'll be in nutritional ketosis and I'll be getting all the benefits. And
so the thing that irks me particularly is that people associate being in ketosis, whether it's exogenous, so ketone drinks, or endogenous, they go, ketosis equals fat burning. That is not the case. When you are in ketosis, ketone bodies in the blood stop your fat cells releasing more fat. That's the way that you don't go into ketoacidosis. So when ketones get to a certain level, ketones do this sort of a product inhibition on their own production. So if you're in a dietary ketosis from following a low carb diet or fasting, that your ketones that you produce naturally are from fat. So you're mobilizing fat, you are burning fat, and then you're turning them into ketones. And then that sort of slows down the fat release. It's sort of a little bit of a cycle, but there's still ketone production from fat burning. However, if you take a ketone drink, those haven't arrived from you burning fat. You have not burnt any fat to get exogenous ketones in your blood. So you've got exogenous ketones in your blood and you actually suppress your fat mobilization. So when you're in exogenous ketosis, you're actually slowing down fat release from the fat cells. So on that metabolic biochemistry kind of count, exogenous ketones do not equal fat burning. However, there is a way where I believe that exogenous ketones could be useful for weight loss, and that seems to be through appetite regulation. So a lot of people report when they're following a ketogenic diet that they're less hungry. And people taking ketone salts, commercially available salts, often report that they're less hungry. So if ketones themselves suppress appetite, which I believe is, you know, possible, and I would believe that as an effect, then you take exogenous ketones, you feel less hungry, so you eat less and therefore create a calorie deficit. So it's not through fat burning, it's through regulation of appetite that ketones may be a weight loss tool, not because you drink them and they melt your fat away, like, you know, something that you buy over the web, you know, like Ultimate XXXL fat melter. It's not like a supplement like that. That's biochemically not how it's working. It may well be appetite suppression and appetite effects that it's going to be helpful for people trying to achieve weight loss.
Okay. Yeah. So anyone who's getting into exogenous ketones and salts are the most popular because they're commercially available, that you can't just, eat away and have these salts and think, oh yeah, I'm melting fat away. You've got to work at it.
Yes, but it should be easier, because if you take the salts and the ketones suppress your appetite, then you should be able to eat less.
Mm-hmm.
But if you eat crap and take salts, you're not going to lose any weight. You have to, it's like part of a whole picture of, you know, that's the thing with the biohacking community, right? You have to do the basics, right? Diet, exercise, and sleep before you look for all these extra little bits on the top. Mm-hmm. And as an elite athlete, researching ketone supplements, you know, so we've seen that taking our ketone ester improves cycling performance by about 2%, which is great. But that's only going to be valuable to you if you're rested and alert and you've done the training. You know, there's no point making Joe Bloggs on the street 2% faster on a bike if he hasn't done the training and then be like, oh, you can race Bradley Wiggins, that's fine. You know, it's only going to make a difference once you've got all these other things optimal. So if you've got all of your riders at the start of the Tour de France and they've all done optimal training and optimal nutrition, they've got all of the pieces in place, and, you know, then you've got some on the top level, top end of that field, who are all physiologically and genetically kind of superior than the others, perhaps. And those are the guys that could win. If you then give one of those guys exogenous ketones, then maybe that's going to be the really big difference between winning or losing. But you have to do the basics right first. So if you're going to start supplementing with ketones in your diet, make sure that you address other factors.
The foundation.
No quick fix.
Yeah. I think I can see time-wise we're coming up for the hour, and I try to keep most interviews around that time, but I definitely want to get you on again and talk about high-level athletes and ketones. That's going to be fascinating. I've got a lot of questions about that. It's fascinating talking to you, just even maybe saying, well, ketones for brain performance, nootropics, can you get sort of something where you can combine exogenous ketones with a nootropic? Yeah. To get a real boost for your brain. So
I think the dynamite's going to be exogenous ketones and caffeine.
Okay. Yeah.
Caffeine and maybe L-theanine as well, just, you know, move you off.
Man. Yeah. And if anyone's in the biohacking world and they love that brain performance supplements, I can imagine this, you know, you're going to have a whole bunch of people wanting
brain health. It's all great, isn't it?
Exactly. So, so esters sound more efficient than salts when they help you with your ketone levels then. And also, I believe you don't get the major side effects of stomach issues, of gastrointestinal distress with esters as you do with salts.
From my experience working with them and my experience taking both of them, I've had pretty awful side effects when you go take too much of the salt. So at the low dose, the salt is kind of fine, but the levels of ketones that you get with the... So what I was experimenting with was 1 and 2 times the recommended dose of the salt, so 1 or 2 sachets, basically, because I was trying to... I was like, I took one, and my levels weren't particularly high, maybe 1 millimolar. And as someone who's used to working with the ester and getting people up to 3 to 4, I was a bit disappointed. So I was like, well, I'll take twice as much of this. And the first time I did that, I was fine. And my blood ketone levels were still pretty disappointing, not that much higher, 1.2, 1.3. That's from double the dose, so all of that extra sodium and that sort of thing. Then anyway, I was fine with it the first time. The next time I took it, I was glued to the toilet for about 5 hours. It was not pleasant at all. So I think there's more risk, especially if you're an athlete, taking in a very salty hyperosmolar solution compared with the ester. And I've worked with, I must have worked with, 100, maybe more than 100 athletes taking this ketone ester through. I've been working with the team and also a participant in some of the studies for sort of 7 or 8 years now. And one person has been sick, and that was because the drink was like this thick milkshakey thing at the time. And, you know, it was just quite natural that he might feel a bit sick doing that on the rowing machine. And so one person was sick. Some people feel a little bit like lightheaded or kind of buzzing, but that, you know, that could be a beneficial side effect. So we've had pretty minimal GI distress, and I know that in other people's hands they've had it's been slightly less well tolerated, but I mean largely quite well tolerated. And as well as the salt, I think it's a bit of a dangerous kind of in terms of the GI side effects. It's either fine or not fine. Mm-hmm. And a few people had reported, I did a more of a sort of a wider study of the salt, and quite a few people reported just feeling a bit nasty. Mm-hmm.
So would you say those are the two major side effects that taking exogenous ketones would be, is the gastrointestinal irritation, and then the, if you take it in the salt format, that you're ingesting a lot of salt, and we don't know physiologically what you're going to be potentially doing by taking a lot of salts in that form?
Yes. So the main side effects that we know to date are the salt ingestion, the potential for having L-hydroxybutyrate, the potential for GI distress more with the salt, but also, you know, like potentially if you take a high dose of the ester as well. We've done increasing dose studies up with the ester, and it seems like there'd be an advisable upper limit. As with natural physiologic ketone levels, you know, sort of 7 to 8, we wouldn't necessarily start to advise people to go higher than that, because at the end of the day, any ketone in your blood, it's still an acid. So if you overdosed, you could end up in acidosis of it, if you took too much exogenous ketones. So that would be a side effect that you would want to watch out for in people who had impaired buffering capacity. But other than that, I mean, like I said, we still need more long-term studies, because it is possible that taking exogenous ketones long-term may have like minor side effects that we just don't know about yet. But it's nothing that wouldn't happen if you were following a ketogenic diet, I imagine, because if there were long-term effects, it would be through ketones signaling and modulating your DNA expression and things like that. And that would happen if you're following a ketogenic diet, we think. But it's all kind of speculative at this stage. And so where we're at the moment is, you can take them, it's safe. They're ketone esters, and ketone esters are generally recognized as safe. They've got been approved by the FDA, or our ketone ester has. It's been through that process. Sorry, just plug my laptop in, it's about to die. Our ketone ester, FDA approved, generally recognized as safe. We've approached WADA and it's approved for use in athletes. So it's you know, fine to go ahead and use. And the ketone salts, as you say, they're commercially available already. And so people are taking them out there, and nobody's reporting any serious adverse effects yet. So I would use them with confidence.
Is there anything people need to be aware of in the keto salt world where they could, there's different formats of the salts that one salt might be better for you or not? I just thought of that.
I think, you've got like, whether you could have calcium with it or potassium with it or sodium with it, that might be like an individual choice. I know that if you're following a ketogenic diet, sometimes you can be deficient in some salt. So actually taking ketones with salt may be beneficial for those people, pop them up to levels that they're not getting either through their diet or if their kidneys are excreting more salt. So it may be helpful there, but I don't really know all of the ins and outs about which one would be which kind of partner ion you would want to have more of delivering with the ketone. I think that's something that needs to be worked on more in future research.
Okay. All right. We've got through a lot. Like I said, we're on that hour mark, but Brianna, can I get you on again to talk about high level athletes? I mean, you're just a beacon of knowledge here, and I've got, I'd like to extract more of this out from you to educate people.
Yeah, no, you get me talking and then I go, so recently did my PhD defense and they sort of started me off and then 3 hours later I stopped talking and they sort of sat there and looked at me.
You actually, whilst you just mentioned your PhD, a quirky little fact, when because I'm going to link to your profile, and because anyone in America might be, or anywhere else in the world, they'll see your PhD as a DPhil, and that's that is a PhD, but it's an Oxford terminology, is it?
Oxford and Cambridge like to set themselves apart from the other universities. You know, it's not a PhD. It's not a philosophy doctorate. It's a doctor of philosophy. So they call it a DPhil, and that means that you've been awarded that degree from Oxford or Cambridge. And I think that they have some sort of stuffy regulations about the work that you do has to meaningfully contribute to the body of scientific knowledge. So it has to be. It can't just be, you know, a lot of work. It has to be important and a lot of work.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, if you see DPhils, you know they've gone through a lot.
they've been to Oxford or Cambridge.
Yeah.
Suffered under there.
That's fascinating. Well, I didn't even know that. So another thing I learned today, other than all the other points. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope I've covered all the major questions, but I'm definitely going to get you on again to talk about high level athletes and even more about exogenous ketones.
Yeah, well, hopefully there'll be some news on when our ester will be available in the not too distant future.
Fantastic. Great. Any other closing remarks you want to get across about ketones before we...
Yeah, I think I'd just like to finish by saying like metabolism and burning fuel is just like really central to so many processes. You know, it's like central to every process in the body. It's central to... cancer, for example, and as we mentioned, neurodegenerative diseases. So where I'm really excited to see the ketogenic diet and exogenous ketones being applied is in all of these different clinical situations. So I think that it's really, really exciting for the wider community to kind of understand that ketones are a beneficial thing, a good thing. And then as that becomes more accepted, we'll be able to kind of test out how they could be used in different clinical situations and really potentially have a very big social impact. You mentioned people doing it for ketogenic diets for weight loss and diabetes as well. So I think the potential applications for ketone bodies are vast because metabolism is this really central to our existence. And so I think that's the kind of like the thought that I'd like to leave people to kind of mull over. It's not just like a little thing that we're going to take and it's going to make you run faster or think faster. It's something that all of our cells are doing, burning fuel. And so it's by altering fuel selection and altering fuel provision, we can have really profound, like systematic whole body effects in health and in disease as well. So mm-hmm. I'm really excited to see where this goes in the future.
Yeah, very much so. Well, again, thank you so much for that. And I'll let people know when you come on again.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brianna.
Bye-bye.
Bye.